Welcome back to you all from Reconsidered Live here on Jump Radio. I am Andy Michaels. Joining me is a very special guest for this week, Dr. Stephanie C. Jenkins. She is an assistant professor in the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State University. She is the co-founder and former co-director of the Phronesis Lab for Engaged Ethics, as well as the current director of the Oregon State University Disability Network. Dr. Jenkins, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andy. Thanks so much for having me.
How are you? First and foremost,
well.
How are you doing? Yeah, you're well? Okay, that's good. I want to get this out of the way before we go on to this interview. I want to tell you a story about philosophy and me, if I may.
Okay. I'd love to hear it.
All right. This goes back to my high school days. And this is pretty pathetic. But all through school, K through 12, I never liked being told what to do, getting homework assigned to me. I didn't like having to have a schedule that I had to follow. So when my senior year came around, I decided that I was going to try to take a bunch of, blow off classes. The first class that I would take, for half my senior year, I thought at the time was the biggest blow off class there was. And that was philosophy. And I thought it was just going to be a blow off because the teacher was, known for just having an open door policy and being very relaxed, very cool. And, just exactly the type of teacher that should be teaching high school philosophy. And so here I am, just jerk in my senior high school year that, did whatever I would want to do. And then like every morning I would just stroll into philosophy like a half hour late. I never did any of the homework, any of the assigned work. I didn't care because I just assumed, and I guess I should say I was paying attention sometimes. I wasn't just completely ignoring everything and thinking it was ridiculous. I thought it was cool, but I just didn't want to do any of the work. And I assumed that the philosophy teacher would just give me a, C and like, all right, whatever, see ya, like everybody else was. When it came down to the end and we were all told, okay, here are your current grades, I was failing philosophy. And it's like, how does somebody fail philosophy? And I was. And so, for 1 hour one day, we like pulled a desk out into the hallway. I attempted to do an entire semester's worth of work, philosophy, and I ended up getting a D in the class. Had I not done that, I would not have graduated easily. So that was my philosophy story and lesson learned, that philosophy is not just some blow-off, and it's a very, interesting subject, and I think it's cool that you're able to take fish and put that with philosophy. But what about your early days?
Well, thanks so much for sharing that story. It's actually really unusual for high school students in the United States to have the opportunity to take a class in philosophy. So I'm excited to learn that you were able to do so.
And, I completely blew it off and did not take it seriously at all. And see, that's the problem. I should have realized how cool that was, especially where I went to high school. Having a class like that was not something that you would think would take place in the school that I was at.
Well, it's awesome that you have later in life taken up an interest in philosophy. So thanks for having me on your show.
Yes, thank you. But what about your early days, like when you were going through high school? What was young Stephanie Jenkins like?
So I like to think of myself as, I was a natural philosopher insofar as, like you, I was defiant, but also intellectually curious. And I was fortunate enough to be introduced to philosophy through competitive debate. So I was able to kind of read some of my favorite thinkers at an early age. I was also a budding musician. I started playing the piano when I was about five, and played that up through until I got to high school. I decided that I wanted to make some more noise. So I picked up the drums and played in a jazz band at my high school in Maine.
Wow, that's awesome. What about your parents? What were they like? Actually, Pat, your mother, comment. Hi, Mom. Yeah, she commented on the Jump Radio post about tonight, wanting to know how to listen. You know, your mother's listening. Hello, Mrs. Jenkins. Were your parents hippies? You know,
definitely not hippies. They were very supportive of my love of music, in terms of making sure that I got lessons and, you know, traveling me to my various events as a young student. My dad is a musician, plays the guitar, and he introduced me to some of the greats, most importantly, Jimi Hendrix.
Nice. So when you were young, listening to Jimi Hendrix, what other music did you listen to?
So I grew up listening to classic rock, in addition to Hendrix, primarily Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, but also jazz, as I played in a jazz band in high school, and Modesky Martin and Wood. Those were sort of my most important musical influences before I came across Phish.
What was your band's name?
So it was just this sort of school jazz band, and then the rock band that I played in didn't get far enough to the point that we actually had a name.
Did you have any songs? Or you just covering?
We did not write original music. So I never got to that point in my music career where I was sort of creating original songs and things like that.
Do you still play the drums?
So I took a hiatus during sort of my graduate school career, but I actually got back into the drums relatively recently. I have a kit in my garage, you know, much to the complaints of my neighbors. And I take lessons with a colleague at Oregon State who also is a Phish fan.
Nice. So when was your first introduction to Phish? You know, where were you? When? How did you learn about Phish? I think it's a very important thing that everybody should know and remember if they're going to be a Phish fan. Was their first experience
Absolutely.
With Phish? Yeah. When was
that? So I was first introduced to Phish my freshman year of high school when a friend from jazz band gave me a copy of a live one. Because I was a budding drummer at the time, that the thing that drew me into Phish was I was blown away by Fishman's drumming.
Nice.
Right, that he was able to, as a rock musician, play the drums like a percussionist.
Right.
And so that's what drew me in.
So he gave you a live one, but what was it like listening to it for that first time? Do you remember?
It was unlike anything that I had heard before. It combined my favorite classic rock sort of influences, but in an improvisational style, right? So it brought together my love for rock and improvisation through jazz music. And so I listened to the album over and over and over again, just on repeat. The same friend gave me a few tapes. They weren't full shows, just sort of mixed songs that he pulled together that he thought that I should listen to. And that led me to Billy Breathes, which I would lie down in my bedroom with headphones and just listen to it on repeat for hours.
Right. So giving you a live one was an incredibly smart move by your friend there. Is your friend still a fan? Do you guys you know, see shows together at all? Or?
So we're only in touch online, and he is not still a regular Phish goer, but maybe when they go to Bangor this summer, he will revisit them.
Nice. That's interesting that the person who turned you on to them isn't really into them that much anymore. That's interesting. When was your first show then? When did you decide you were going to go see them live?
So my first show wasn't actually until February 24th in 2003 at the Continental Airlines Arena in New Jersey.
Uh-huh. How did you get there?
So I went to that show with a dear friend of mine from college who actually was one of your previous interviews on this show.
Oh, really? Who's that?
Nathan Toby.
Ah, okay. Nice.
Yeah, he was the meme from the Alpharetta
right,
show a couple years back.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about him a couple days ago, and it's like you never see the guy anymore. He handled his fame really well. He was, you know, he had his 15 minutes. Everybody loved him. His memes were getting shared. And then he just kind of just went off and, you know, did his own thing. And like, it was like, good for him, man. Good for not becoming a huge ordeal. And you know what I mean? Like, all right, good job, Nathan.
Nate's a great guy, so that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. He handled everything perfectly.
That was for both of us our first show. So we went to our first shows together. Nice. And we've been to a number of shows together, met up since.
Nice. Were you there when he, you know, became the, what was it? Was it Rift that was playing? I think it was Rift.
I don't remember actually. Yeah. I'm sure he does.
Yeah. I think it was Rift, and it was perfect because he was all blue and, you know, yeah. Rift and everything. Yeah. So, were you guys there? Were you with him at that show?
I was not at that show. Oh. And what was funny was, you know, the moment when my phone blew up with, you know, friends of friends saying, wait, is that Nathan on the webcast?
Nice. So you saw your first show in 2003.
Yeah.
And when was that again?
When was it? It was in February of 2003.
Okay.
That was the show where B.B. King came out in the first set.
Oh, okay. All right. What's do you have like a favorite memory, favorite song from that show?
Chalk Dust.
All right. Maybe I'll play that tonight if we got time. All right. So you saw your first show in 2003. When would you say that you decided this is it? I'm going to see them live. I'm going to tour. And you know, between having heard a live one and then seeing them in 2003, a lot mm-hmm. happened. Were you keeping up with the band between those periods?
Yeah, so I had wanted to go see Phish for a really long time, right? From the moment that I first listened to a live one. You know, part of the why it took so long was that I was young enough that, you know, that my parents had a say, right, in terms of my ability to go to shows. Once I sort of became a student, I focused on my academic career, and I also had a lot of health problems that inhibited my ability to travel. So once I got to a show, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And obviously, right, sort of things changed relatively soon.
Right.
And when they came back, I went to shows off and on. Mm-hmm. Up until they played their first festival at Watkins Glen,
mm-hmm.
and at the time I was working on my dissertation and dealing with some personal and health trouble, and just I decided that what I needed in my life was Phish, and so I took off by myself and went to the festival and never looked back.
At the Super Bowl, so you saw the Storage Jam.
Yes, I did.
Oh, I'm so jealous. were you at Magna Ball too?
I was.
Okay, and we'll talk about Kurt Ball in a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
what was Coventry? What was that like? You know, having you just saw your first show a year prior, and now the band's already saying we're done.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Well, so Coventry was a really mixed experience for me because I wasn't there.
Right.
I was absolutely devastated. I went to my first Phish festival, it in Limestone, actually with Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wanted to go to Coventry, but I had surgery right before the show. And mm-hmm. I was going to go plans to go with Nathan and his parents, but my surgeon said absolutely under no circumstances are you to show up to a music festival, right? So I decided not to. And I thought I was never going to be able to see my favorite band again, and that I wasn't going to be able to see them off. And just like the many negative experiences that I've had in my life, it turned out to be, I think that Trey called it like curveballs or a gift in disguise or alternative packaging right. in the recent Ask Trey series.
Nice. Yeah. I got into the band around when you started seeing them live, 2002, 2003. And, I was, late middle school, early high school, and finding out that they broke up. Shortly thereafter, it was like, well, shit, like I had never had a favorite band for so many years growing up. I just listened to, what everybody else was listening to or whatever I thought was cool. But then I discovered Phish, and like that was it for me. I was under 18 still. And so the concept of me going to any shows wasn't possible. And then they broke up, and I was like, well, shit, now what do I do? So then for like, you know, the 5 years after they broke up to when they came back, All I did was listen to Phish. I mean, I listened to some other bands too, but I just ingested so much Phish that when they came back, I could hardly contain myself. What was that? What was that like for you when you found out, you know, that they were coming back? And did you try to make Hampton?
So I didn't. I was in the middle of my graduate studies, and I was actually pretty bitter about the breakup, and you know, I kind of felt betrayed by the band, and so I didn't try very hard to get to a lot of shows, and it wasn't until I went to some of the shows at Madison Square Garden a couple. In around 2010 and 2011, but it was really going to the festival and getting back into the experience, getting reconnected to the community that got me back.
Gotcha. All right, let's talk about philosophy okay. Here, and we'll circle back around to Phish. This is a question that I don't think is one that is easily answerable. What is philosophy?
So the usual answer that you'll get in response to this question is that philosophy comes from the Greek word for love of wisdom. Mm-hmm. But in my introductory classes, I like to give the students a definition from a textbook that I use that defines philosophy as the art of questioning everything. Mm-hmm. Right? Philosophy is a discipline that challenges received beliefs and values that are handed down by parents, politicians, religious figures and other authorities. I also like to describe it to my students as a skill set for living a meaningful life, because the skills that you learn when you study philosophy are things that carry over into pretty much anything that you do, whether it's identifying and questioning assumptions, evaluating and constructing arguments, or creative and critical thinking.
So how does somebody decide that they're going to begin to explore philosophy? You know, what drew you to it? Did you always, at an early age, were you philosophical at an early age?
Well, so what got me reading philosophy, first of all, was my experience in competitive debate. The style of debate that I participated in used a lot of philosophy. And I learned that my competitors were getting their arguments from basically sort of Cliff Notes descriptions from philosophers. And so I learned that if I read the primary text, that it gave me an advantage. So it started out because I liked to win. But then I learned that philosophy gave me a framework and a method for being intellectually curious and asking questions in a way that was really helpful as a young woman, right? As the high school student, challenging teachers sometimes would get me in trouble with authority figures.
Oh, yes.
But if the question came from a famous philosopher, right? Instead of Stephanie Jenkins, right? You know, 15-year-old high school student. But all of a sudden, the same ideas were taken really seriously.
Why didn't I think of that? There were so many opportunities I had to, you know, get out of shit just by, that's amazing.
Yeah, philosophy definitely channeled sort of my teenage rebellion intellectually productive forms. Right.
I may have attempted some sort of, you know, bullshitting my way through the philosophy course in high school, but I don't think I tried anything as smart as that.
Well, the thing that also that made it stick was that I really just came to believe that ideas matter, right? Mm-hmm. Ideas can anger and incite, mobilize, unify and divide individuals and communities, right? And so I really wanted to understand them and how they worked, and also use those ideas to try to make the world a better place.
So were your tactics working in debate? Were you winning? Were you, owning your opponents?
My senior year of high school, I won every tournament in the state of Maine that I went to, including the state championship and qualifying for a couple different national tournaments.
And you had to debate on the side of things that you may not necessarily have agreed with, right?
Yeah. So the style of debates that I did are switch side debates, which means you have to debate both sides of the topic. Uh-huh. And that was one of probably the most formative experiences in my education that I had, because it forced me to engage with ideas that I disagreed with.
Right. Yeah, it would be nice if more people, especially today's world in this country would do that. You know, objectively look at both sides of something and intelligently debate as opposed to just yelling at each other and fighting.
Absolutely. Right. And so I try to take this into my philosophy classroom where I have students work on assignments where they research and write a position that they disagree with. Mm. But also challenging people to see beyond kind of the dualism that there's only two sides to an issue. Mm. It's part of philosophy is unpacking those assumptions and making things more complicated than they might seem initially.
Right. So in my research before our conversation here, you use the words do philosophy, you know, somebody doing philosophy. How does somebody do philosophy? What does that entail?
So that's a fantastic question. Thanks for asking.
I mean,
so,
I had an opportunity in high school to learn how to do philosophy, but I, you know, kind of fucked it up. So why don't you teach me how somebody does philosophy?
So if you don't mind my asking, sure. Before I answer the question, I'm actually curious how you would answer it.
I would, the way I see somebody doing philosophy, and this is incredibly cliche, is sitting by yourself and pondering and questioning everything. Your existence, the universe, the bugs on the floor, everything. And not always coming to, you know, conclusions and having answers and then, ultimately, you know, driving that person insane. but seriously, that's how I see doing philosophy is just questioning everything.
That's a great answer. So either in your high school class, you absorbed something that you maybe didn't realize you did, or you did some great research.
No, because, I'm a natural genius. That's why I never, I just didn't care about any of that crap because I already knew everything.
Yeah. So the thing that I would like to change about your answer is the image of it, that philosophy is something that you do by yourself with a book, right, in your room.
Right.
I like to understand philosophy as something that we do with friends and in our community, that it's really important to have dialogue and to get feedback about our ideas.
Right.
To go back to your question, right? How does someone do philosophy? Mm-hmm. I believe, and I teach this to especially my introductory students, that most people actually already do philosophy. They just might not realize it. Mm-hmm. So, German philosopher Immanuel Kant, he lived through sort of the 18th and the turn to the 19th century, identified what he considered to be the four basic questions of philosophy. And those questions were, what can I know? What shall I do? What may I hope? And what is being human? Mm. Right. So if you've ever asked yourself things like, how do I live a meaningful life? Was it for this my life I sought? Like, you're doing philosophy.
Right.
And so just like any skill, whether it's playing an instrument, riding a bike, or playing, you know, a sport like baseball, you get better by doing it. Uh-huh. And so the great thing about philosophy is that you're not alone in thinking through those big, really difficult questions. There are centuries of great thinkers who devoted their lives to studying them. Uh-huh. And so to go back to your question, what can you do? One of the great starting points is to pick up a book. And reading philosophy is one of the ways that you can engage with those great ideas. And I'm always happy to make recommendations if fans are looking for a place to start. But the text that I actually usually start out recommending is Jeanette Becknell's Why Music Moves Us. It's a textbook that I use in the Philosophy School of Fish class. Uh-huh. But it also speaks, I think, to fans who are, you know, really passionate about music and touring, and it provides sort of philosophical answers to that question, right? Why we care about what we do so much. You can also take advantage of open access public philosophy resources. So, for example, if you go to the Philosophy School of Fish website, which is just philosophyschoolofffish.com, mm-hmm. I've been sort of curating a number of free resources for fans who are interested. So there's an example syllabus from the class. There are video interviews with scholars that the students read in the class, as well as videos from the Gorge colloquium that was held at the Gorge Run last summer, mm-hmm. And interviews from artists from the fish community that my students produced. There's also an increasing number of podcasts coming from people that work in professional philosophy that are designed for members of the public. A couple that I like a lot are called the Unmute Podcast and the Partially Examined Life. Mm-hmm. And you can also come to a philosophy school of fish event when you're on tour.
So who was your favorite philosopher?
So my favorite philosopher is a French philosopher named Michel Foucault,
okay,
who studied philosophy from a historical perspective. He would pick topics that he was concerned about that were important to him, whether they were prisons, sexuality, and madness, and look at how our understanding of what those things are has changed over time,
right?
So, to demonstrate that they're not natural and that they are actually contingent.
So you said, a great way to obviously do philosophy is to just open a philosophy book. So let's say one of his books. How does a book like that start? What are you reading when you open up one of these philosophy books?
So Foucault's works are a little bit unusual for a philosophy text in that they don't start out with sort of presenting a traditional argument. Mm-hmm. Rather, he will explain the concept that he is looking at from a historical perspective. Right, he'll describe it. So mm-hmm. when Discipline and Punish starts out, it's a famous text that describes in really graphic detail the execution of Damien the Regicide. And so, right, he was drawn and quartered, and the torture even continued past his death.
Right.
And then he juxtaposes that with the timetable of a prison, that the right sort of the mundane, seemingly not violent, schedule of a prisoner in terms of all the daily aspects of their life. Mm-hmm. And then he asks the question, right, why is it that in a very short period of time, we went from torture, right, is the way of punishing people, to taking away their freedom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent question. At what point was the turning point? But then again, there are still, there's still torture happening in this world.
Absolutely. And there are actually a number of sort of contemporary Foucault scholars who are doing research about torture as well as prison abolition.
Wow. Can anybody explore philosophy, or do you have to be a certain type of person, a certain type of brain?
So just like I said that, most people do philosophy when they ask themselves questions about living a meaningful life or how we as humans should live together. Pretty much anyone can do philosophy. It just takes being interested in it and putting the effort in.
Right. Let's talk about your education. You graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Emory University with a bachelor's in philosophy. Where is Emory University?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay. So you grew up in Bangor, Maine, and then you went to Atlanta, Georgia for college. Why there? Why Emory University?
So Emory University has one of the sort of most successful and competitive debate teams in the country. And so it was actually the debate team that drew me there.
Gotcha. And then you received a master's in philosophy and a dual PhD in philosophy and women's studies from Pennsylvania State University in 2012. So you, mm-hmm. you achieved a bachelor's in philosophy, but you decided to keep going. And what took you to Pennsylvania? And my God, I can't imagine getting a dual PhD.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
So when I was looking at graduate programs, I was looking at programs in a variety of different disciplines, right? Philosophy, women's studies, and rhetoric. And the Penn State was the only school that did not make me choose between fields that I loved, because they were just getting this dual degree program in philosophy and women's studies started.
Gotcha.
So that's how I ended up there.
Nice. Okay. When did you know that you wanted to teach, that you wanted to be a teacher, a professor?
That's a funny question, because I often revisit it in different forms throughout my life. Mm. And so when I went to graduate school, I didn't know that I wanted to be a philosophy professor. I just knew that I loved philosophy and I wanted to spend some more time studying it. And so the thing that's a really just incredible gift of graduate education is that you get to devote your life to the study of things that you're interested in. And so I just decided that I wanted to, you know, devote all of my time to the study of philosophy. And in the process of getting my PhD, part of the requirements are working as an instructor. And I just found in the process of teaching philosophy that I really loved doing it. Mm. And then as a, in developing my own research interests, got interested in writing philosophy and doing it sort of as a scholar. And so it kind of developed naturally and unfolded over time.
How, did you have any other professorships? Did you teach any other courses before going to Oregon State?
So as a graduate student at Penn State, I taught a number of courses and held a sort of a teaching assistantship and research positions while I was there. But my assistant professorship at Oregon State is my first sort of tenure track position as a full faculty member.
How did you end up there? You've moved a lot throughout the country. What took you to Oregon?
So I like to make the comparison that being an academic is a lot like being in the military insofar as you move to where the job is. And so I moved to Oregon because that was the job that I got.
Gotcha. Okay. What's it like out there, by the way? I've never been to Oregon. Is it beautiful? As beautiful as people say?
It is beautiful. It actually reminds me quite a bit of Maine, just with rain instead of snow.
Oh, well, I'd take the rain. All right. So when did you decide that you wanted to incorporate fish into your teaching? That's something that I'm sure many of people have thought about, you know, sitting on their couch one day, you know, but you actually took it and ran with it and developed a course. When and why did you decide you wanted to do that?
So it was something that I had dreamed about and joked about for a long time, but that I didn't really think was possible. But when I was in graduate school, there was a professor in my program who was, I don't even know if this was true, but he was rumored to be REM's banned philosopher. And so when I heard that, I said, wait a minute, banned philosopher? Nice. That's a thing. And how do I do that? So that idea was planted in my mind and kind of, you know, percolated for quite some time. And then it was actually at the Dix run in 2012 during the light jam I got the idea. I had this epiphany, right? Fish shows are great places to get some thinking done. Listening to jams is an important part of my thought process. I have some of my best ideas at shows. So I asked myself, why am I not sharing this with my students? Mm-hmm. And so that's the when. In terms of the why, there's a couple of reasons for this. The first is to implement experiential learning into my classes. So my favorite philosopher that I mentioned, Michel Foucault, wrote what he called experience books. And what he meant by that is that he believed that in the process of writing, that he should not be the same after the book is done as he was before it started. And he also wanted his readers to change through their encounter with his work. Yeah. And so I made it my goal to create the experience classroom because I wanted chalk dust without the torture. Mm-hmm. The second reason was a personal in terms of my own healing. At the time, when I was a graduate student, especially, I really kept my life as a fan secret. Mm-hmm. And so my life was really compartmentalized. I was concerned that if my colleagues knew that I was a fish fan, that they would read of various misconceptions and stereotypes of what it meant to be a fan.
Interesting.
And evaluate my work from that perspective. And so I was undergoing a health crisis. I had been disabled by a progressive, nearly fatal illness, and I was just starting my career as a professional philosopher. And so part of what happened during this jam was I just realized if I'm going to survive my profession, I have to do it as myself, mm-hmm. right? And so it took too much to keep up that disguise. So I put my wingsuit on and merged my two passions.
You're as bad as Katie Turr, by the way. My God.
Sorry, not really.
No, I don't think anybody is as close. You know, that's interesting that the Dix 12 light jam effectively changed your life. And it's fascinating that fish is able to do that. They've done that obviously with so many of us, and so many of us have lifted off because of particular jams, you know, particular performances. Holly Bowling is another example with the Tahoe tweezer. And then, you know, you were saying, Michel Foucault, he wanted people to, be different after reading his work. Do you think that Fish wants people to leave their shows feeling different?
Absolutely, right. And so we're talking about experience books and experience classrooms. Mm-hmm. We can also think about the experience jam, right, or the experience gag.
Right.
If you think right back to the Halloween show this past fall, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That was an experience that put us in the position of asking questions like, how do I know if mm-hmm. something is true, mm-hmm. right? How do I evaluate evidence? Mm-hmm. And so in this way, I think through Fish's performances, right, that they often have us experience philosophical concepts.
When you went to Oregon State, did you start with Fish in your course? I mean, what were you? Well, that sounded weird, like you were eating a meal. What were you doing first when you went to Oregon State?
So my position is in moral theory, which means that my primary area of research and teaching is in ethics. Mm-hmm. And so I teach a lot of courses at the undergraduate and graduate level in this area. Which is to say that I did not start out my job teaching the philosophy of Fish.
Okay.
Rather, I started after this experience at Dix 2012. Right, what I started doing was integrating music into my classes using different songs or albums as case studies, and also as a way of trying to relate to my students. And then I started talking to my colleagues in the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion about this, you know, idea that I had been dreaming about since I was a graduate student, about teaching a class about Fish and philosophy. And I had assumed, right, that the answer would be absolutely not. Mm. And instead it was, you should totally pursue that.
Really? So when you went to propose this course to the university, you went in thinking that this isn't going to go anywhere?
Yes, I think that I had internalized some of, right, sort of the misconceptions, or at least projected it onto the people around me. Uh-huh. But also that it might, teaching a class about Fish might seem like it's too narrow, right, for an undergraduate class. Mm-hmm. And so I spent some time thinking about how to make a class about Fish and philosophy relatable to students who aren't fans, and how Fish can be used to demonstrate some abstract and dense philosophical concepts in concrete ways. I just started talking to my colleagues about it, and so some other professors encouraged me to pursue it. And mm-hmm. so then I started taking the idea through the administrative hierarchy at the university. My school director in the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at the time, Ben Mutchler, actually played in a jazz band with Mike Gordon in high school. Oh. And he also is a musician, and so he was highly supportive of that.
Yeah.
I then went to the dean of the College of Liberal Arts, Larry Rogers, who was actually the first person to suggest that I physically take students on a field trip.
Nice.
And so I'm really incredibly fortunate to be at a university that is so supportive right. of experimental philosophical methods and experiential learning. We support innovative work in the arts and humanities, and are also one of the few universities in the country that is a Grammy Museum University affiliate. The director of the Grammy Museum, Bob Santelli, actually has a position here at OSU where he works as the director of popular music. Mm-hmm. And so I just I happened to land my first job at a place that will support this kind of creative intellectual pursuit.
So you didn't receive any hesitation or resistance from administration and from coworkers. Was there any hesitation at all anywhere else, or was everybody like on board with this?
The biggest pushback I got might have been from some fans, actually, because the class is an online class, and so there I think were some criticisms that the students should have to physically go to shows, that they shouldn't be able to meet the concert requirements by attending concerts via webcast.
That's interesting. I don't agree. Well,
so I actually think that's a valid concern.
Right, of course.
But it's logistically not possible for the class to only be offered physically on campus.
Right.
Because if it's an in-person class, it means everybody has to be in Corvallis, Oregon for the duration of the course.
Right.
And unfortunately, right, there's no Baker's Dozen happening in Corvallis, Oregon.
Exactly.
So
right.
In order for myself and the students to be able to travel to shows, it has to be offered online.
Yeah.
And it works out well because Oregon State has a really highly ranked eCampus program. And so we have some great professionals who are able to provide sort of some assistance in getting the course up and going and maintaining it from a technological side.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also some requirements along with that, which is that I cannot require students in an online course to be anywhere in particular at any particular time. And that's because I've had students take the class who are living in Saudi Arabia while they're taking the course, right? Mm-hmm. And so I can't require that they be in Watkins Glen, New York for a Phish concert.
Right.
So the fact that Phish webcasts so many of their concerts, it makes it possible for me to provide this educational opportunity to the students.
Yeah.
So it started as an online class in 2014. And this past summer, for the first time, I physically took students on a field trip. A subsection of the course was able to enroll in a lab credit. And so I took 6 students in a van up to the Gorge Amphitheater where they camped for 3 nights and for most of them attended their first shows.
Wow. How was that first class in 2014? And, you know, what is a typical philosophy school of Phish course like for anybody that's thinking about enrolling?
Well, the class is a standard philosophy of art and music class. So we cover all the major thinkers that you would in a typical philosophy of art and music class, from Friedrich Nietzsche to Immanuel Kant and Leo Tolstoy. We cover similar topics that you would in a regular philosophy of art and music class. We start out with music ontology, which is a technical term for basically the question, what is music?
Mm-hmm.
We move on to study aesthetics, which is what makes music good. And but we study those topics by using Phish as a case study. And what that does is it takes content that can be really abstract and dense and very difficult for students who are new to philosophy and provides them with a common experience that they can relate to in order to make the content that they're learning more concrete.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll use examples from Phish in our class discussions. They also do a concert field notes assignment where they attend a concert in person or via webcast and then apply course concepts that they're learning to that experience, as well as an artist interview project where they interview an artist from the Phish community.
Can you give me an example of, some of the assignments that you know, you would get back after like a webcast or a student attends a show in person? What are they experiencing? What are they learning?
So they will take concepts that they're studying from the assigned readings and then apply them to topics that stand out to them in their experience of the concert or the webcast.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them will pick out the community, right? Understanding the social nature of music and how groups can form around aesthetic taste.
Mm-hmm.
They will also talk about the phenomenology or the experience of the lights.
Mm-hmm.
They will also talk about the sort of philosophical implications of improvisation, right? For a lot of these students, they not only is Phish their first introduction to music, I'm finding that a lot of students that I teach don't listen to rock bands in general, right? They listen to a lot of electronic music. And
right.
So they are kind of, they're working through that experience as well.
So I assume that most of the students are Phish fans, but those that aren't, what's that like for them? Being somewhat catapulted into a community and experiencing shows, and what's that like for you too, to teach this course to non-fans?
So just to back up, most of the students who take the course are not Phish fans.
Wow, that's interesting.
Right. So the class meets a baccalaureate core requirement at Oregon State in Western culture. So a lot of students will see the course title and sign up for it because they think that it's a cool way to meet a requirement that they have to take anyway.
Uh-huh.
And so that means that probably a third of the students come in having never even heard of Phish.
Wow.
And then a third of them maybe have listened to a little bit of Phish, and then a third or less of them are Phish fans themselves. Mm-hmm. I have a handful of students who sign up each year who aren't currently students at Oregon State, but who are Phish fans who are interested in the course.
Which do you enjoy teaching more, non-fans or fans?
They're different experiences. I should say that I have really, really come to love the process of introducing students who don't know anything about Phish to my favorite band.
Yeah.
And that was something that I don't think I expected when I designed the course, because of course the dream is dorking out over Phish and philosophy with people who are obsessed about those subjects as well. But that's not actually how it works.
Uh-huh.
And it makes sense, because this is what a lot of undergraduate teaching is like, insofar as when I teach an introductory course, most of the students is their first encounter with philosophy. So I just go through that same sort of process with Phish. And it's a lot of fun to see something that I love and that I have that has been a part of my life for so long through new eyes. They ask really interesting questions, and they have varied responses.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the students hate it, right? some of the students leave saying that they're going to go to another show,
mm-hmm.
And the primary response is somewhere in between, where they say, you know what, this isn't the kind of music that does it for me, but wow, I really respect the musicianship of the band.
Mm-hmm.
And even more so, wow, right, this is a really special community.
Right. We talked about how the classes are conducted during tour. And you said you did an actual field trip last year where you guys went to shows. But tell me more about these artist interviews. That seems to be a big thing in the course, the artist mm-hmm. interviews. What is that?
So the artist interview assignment is the final project for the course, where the students are assigned to an interview an artist from the Phish community.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this assignment requires them to do is that they have to formulate philosophical interview questions based on their sort of background research about the artist, but that translate the ideas that they're learning about in the course to someone who isn't enrolled in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually really difficult. And it requires them to put themselves essentially in the position of the professor, right? One of the things that happens in a college course is that even in a small seminar class, the instructor is the person who does most of the communication.
Mm-hmm.
But with this assignment, they have to go out into the world and do philosophy with people. And so they learn a lot. And in a philosophy of art and music class, it really helps for them to do an in-detail case study with someone with experience and expertise in, as an artist.
That's amazing. And it's great that these artists participate as well. Can you give me an example of prominent ones, good interviews that have taken place from the course?
So there's a wide range of participation from the community in this assignment. And this is part of why I think students leave the class so impressed with our community, is just if you go to the website philosophyschoolofphish.com, you can look at there's a list of all of the interviews that have been completed up to this date.
Mm-hmm.
And the time, right, that these artists are willing to share with my students is unlike any opportunity I would be able to provide my students in any other area of my sort of, my career.
Mm-hmm.
So artists that have participated range from, like, Holly Bowling, you mentioned her earlier. She
right.
did an interview early on with students. David Gallo, Tom Marshall, David Welker, Ryan Kerrigan and Teddy Fuller are fan artists who are actually based in Oregon, who have done interviews with my students, uh-huh. as well as Jamie Lee Meyer.
Mm-hmm. What was the David Welker one like? That must have been fascinating.
So I believe that the student interviewed David Welker about the concept of the sublime in art, as well as maybe a little bit about beauty, but it's been a while since I've read that one in particular. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, you can go take a look.
Yes, I will. So most of the students view the current Phish community and culture in a positive light. Am I right?
Yes.
What about you?
Do I view the fish community in a positive light?
Yes.
Absolutely.
No, but how do you view the current fish community and culture? You know, things are obviously neither of us experienced it like in the mid 90s. But from what I understand, things are a lot different now than they were before. So how do you view things the way they are right now?
So I think that fish fans are right. We're a very passionate group who are also right, scholarly about our consumption, about our favorite band. Right. Mm-hmm. If you go to fish.net, we keep track of statistics. Right. We do public history in relation to keeping track of set lists and things along those lines. Mm-hmm. But also that we try to support one another as best we can. And this is something that I have experienced as a, you know, philosophy professor trying to create high impact learning experiences for my students, right? Just the sheer amount of time that the artists volunteer to my students, as well as when I took the students on a field trip to the Gorge Amphitheater, as well as I also took two students to the Halloween run in Las Vegas this fall. They get adopted by crews, right? That fish fans want to talk to them about philosophy. And, and one of my students commented, she couldn't believe how excited fish fans were to talk to her about philosophy. She said, "I love philosophy. I love fish, but it's 8 o'clock in the morning and I haven't had my coffee yet." So in that respect, right, that fish fans will volunteer their time, which is also coming up in the context of the Fish Studies Conference. I regularly receive emails from people who are just reaching out because they want to help.
Yeah.
In terms of my own sort of right health journey, I have had friends who made it physically possible for me to be at shows when I couldn't have been there otherwise, whether that is that I had people I could count on to physically carry me out of the show if I needed it, mm-hmm. or friends who would walk the path from the hotel to the venue to make sure that it was physically accessible for me.
Wow.
So overall, my experience with fish fans is overwhelmingly positive. You know, just like any large community of people, there's going to be outliers who are not positive right, contributors to that community. But one of the things that I find special about us, right, as fish fans, is that we do self-regulate one another.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do.
Right, it's a great sort of case study or microcosm of how democracy works.
Right. What about all right? So let's assume that the band, the band themselves, that they know about the school of philosophy, the Fish School of Philosophy. I mean, there are so many things that revolve around the band right now that fans, obviously there's a whole freaking radio station for one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's podcasts and so there's an actual, collegiate course, philosophy and fish. How do you think, just assuming they feel about it?
So I have not had any direct contact with any members of the band. So the only kind of evidence that I have about this was Trey's response to my question on the Jam On Ask Trey series. Mm-hmm. Which he said, "Wow, a class in fish and philosophy. That's great." So
that's good.
Right. I really appreciate the feedback. Obviously, I hope that they think that it's cool. But right, I mean, they're rock stars. They have their own projects going on.
Right. How do you view each member of the band? What do they each mean to you, and what makes them worthy of philosophical study?
So that's a really interesting question. No one's ever asked me that in sort of the history of the course. So I really appreciate the opportunity to think about this a little bit differently. One of the things that really excites me about philosophy is right getting these new kinds of questions.
Right.
I should say right that you know I don't know any of the band members personally, so I only know their you know their public professional personas. Mm-hmm. And the sort of philosophical inquiry that I do isn't necessarily about analyzing their biographies, but I can tell you a little bit about how each of them are meaningful to me personally.
Yeah.
So Trey studied philosophy in college, right? So I consider Gamehenge, right, the man who stepped into yesterday, to basically be a rock opera about philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in how he has merged from a different perspective than my own, my two passions in life. Also, in relationship to his own right, sort of his experience with addiction and recovery. While my healing journey has been very different, it's been very meaningful for me to see someone go through that process of things falling apart, right, and putting his life back together.
Right.
Fishman got me into Phish, right, because he's a drummer. We actually, the first song that I learned how to play on the drums was When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin. That was also Fishman's first song that he learned to play on the drum, so we shared that in common.
Right.
And because I'm from Maine, I'm really grateful and proud of, right, his commitment to political service and activism. Mike, you know, he seems, from what I have read in his public interviews, to be very interested in art and literature and philosophy. I actually assigned to my students an interview that he did a while back about the relationship between music and religion. And he says something along the lines of, music fills in the holes that, or the gaps that religion leaves open.
Wow.
And I also think he's a great model for putting, right, your role model for putting your wingsuit on. If you can think about examples like the ways that he resists gender norms, right, for a rock star.
Right.
You know, Paige taught me that piano can rock. When I started taking piano lessons, I was trained in classical music and in a very sort of rigorous and disciplined way that by the time I got to high school, I wanted to rebel against and found kind of boring. And so that was what led me to the drums. So I'm grateful for that experience. But right, Paige really changed my understanding of what the keys can do.
Right.
Also, Paige is particularly sort of meaningful for me in my personal healing process because I experienced a sensory processing disorder. And so there was a really long period of time in which I couldn't hear Paige when I was listening to shows. And so only within the past couple of years have I been able to hear Paige again for the first time. And whenever I listen to a show or I'm, you know, physically attending one and Paige does just, you know, like something awesome, it's a reminder to me that I'm on the road, you know, to health.
Wow, that is incredible. I can't imagine, like, not being, that's amazing. You mentioned The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday. Do you present that in your course to your students?
I provide it as an example to students of things that they can look into for further information, but we don't do an in-depth reading of it in a class. So I should actually say as a side note that I have a student who took the class this summer and attended both field trips, who is currently working on a project that he calls The Woman Who Stepped Into Tomorrow.
Ah, nice. So there's going to be like songs and...
So right now he's currently sort of working on the mythology of it and the characters and elements of the story. And if it becomes publicly available, I will definitely let you know.
Yeah, please. Let's talk about the past year here in Phish community. It was a difficult year. We had assault at the Gorge and obviously the cancellation of Curveball and, you know, just other negative, sad things. Are moments like that, the negative and sad moments, studied in your course? And were you at the Gorge when those assaults took place?
So I was at the Gorge with my students.
Okay,
and so it's a interesting question because that created kind of a important, I think, learning opportunity for my students because they went on the field trip and experienced our community at its best, right? There was a lot of turnout at an academic event at, you know, what's essentially a music festival. They interviewed a number of Phish fans who were just overwhelmingly excited to talk to them about philosophy. And they were adopted by fans who just wanted to make sure that they had a good experience and learned a lot while they were at the shows. And so we are in the van going back from the Gorge to Corvallis, Oregon, and they start, you know, sort of reading reviews and news about the shows and discovered that, right, that there were a couple assaults, right, of two Black men at the shows, right, in what is a primarily white community. And so it was a lot of cognitive dissonance for them. They didn't understand how something like that mm-hmm. could happen in a community that's so committed to values like, you know, peace and love and, you know, getting along with each other. Mm-hmm. And so we had some really difficult but important conversations on the ride home about, right, sort of how large communities organize and relate to one another and how racial violence happens. They were concerned about, right, sort of the details of the crime, right? Was it a hate crime or not? And at the time, those were things that we didn't know.
Right.
And, but more importantly, their primary takeaway was, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Right. We want to contribute and make this better. Mm-hmm. And so, a number of the students have been back to shows, right? They're sort of becoming more integrated in the Phish community. They're working on their own research projects. I also joined the education committee for the Fans for Racial Equality.
So the incidents at the Gorge took place, and then Curveball was canceled. You had mentioned earlier in our interview here that Super Bowl was a big moment for you. So were you going to be at Curveball? Were you already there? And,
I was already there. Was, in an RV in the Walmart parking lot getting our crew together.
Oh.
And so we took off and, got into the campgrounds right before they closed it. And so, a subset of my crew was able to spend one night there. Mm-hmm. And, we spent that time catching up with as many people as possible right before we all had to take off. And then the RVs were non-refundable. And we were all there and had the time off. And so we, went to a state park and camped for the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are any teaching moments from Curveball being canceled, and then from the assaults, obviously being the more devastating thing, I think, than Curveball being canceled. but do you feel that there are teaching moments that you can use in the future with your course?
That's a great question. I'll have to think about ways that these might become case studies in future iterations of the class. So I have been for this coming summer thinking about ways that I can revise the module on music and politics mm-hmm. to include sort of some news coverage of the assaults, but also responses within the fan community of as an example of activism and sort of that kind of self-regulation that we do of each other as fans.
Right.
I don't think we can compare what happened at the Gorge and the cancellation of Curveball,
no.
Right? That they're very different sorts of, sort of negative things that happened within the community.
Right.
But in terms of, Curveball, I really liked how Trey thought about this and asked Trey, but when he said that Curveballs are gifts and alternative packaging, at the time it might have been very, very difficult for a number of fans. And I can only speak to my own experience, right? I don't want to speak for other fans, but what happened for me that weekend was that while the festival didn't happen and I was devastated, right, that we didn't get the jams, right? Those are the festival that wasn't. What I got that weekend was intense one-on-one time with Phish fans who are dear to me from around the country, who I don't get that kind of concentrated time with, because usually when we're together, what we're doing is we're seeing live music. Mm-hmm. And so there are kind of two takeaways for me from that. The first one is that it really did, I think, change my relationships to the band, because I love Phish, right, like so many of you, but also because I am building part of my professional career around Phish's live touring schedule. I've kind of blocked out in my mind the possibility that, like people, the lifespan of uh-huh. bands are finite, right? And what I realized at some point this weekend, and what I said to my friends, is, look, like, we are not always going to have the band.
Right.
But we will always have each other, and we'll always have the music,
exactly.
Right? And So there will be, right, J-Rads for Phish. right, the music will live on in other ways. Right. And, you know, I think that that was an important kind of personal moment for me that that didn't happen with Coventry, yeah. right? For Coventry, I think part of it was that I wasn't able to be there because I was recovering from surgery, but also in the time that has passed, I have matured quite a bit as a human. Uh-huh. but second, in terms of right, having time with friends, part of what developed out of that are some important projects for me in terms of the Phish Studies conference and some plans to try to archive art within the Phish community. Right, those are ideas that that were given birth out of the cancellation of Curveball.
Tell me more about the conference that's coming up this spring at Ohio State University.
So the Phish Studies conference will take place May 17th to 19th on Oregon State University's campus here in Corvallis, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be the first academic conference that's hosted at a university that's devoted to Phish, its fans, and its music. So I'm really excited about this event. I think that it is an important moment in the history of the band insofar as that it is demonstrating the scholarly relevance right of the music and what we do together because it's being supported by scholars who aren't Phish fans, right? In order for the event to take place, I had to convince people to support it. And then secondly, there are a lot of Phish fans who really want to do scholarship about Phish. And this event is creating a scholarly opportunity for them to be able to do that work and receive professional credit for it because for a lot of academics, the most the part of our jobs that we tend to get the most credit for are things that count as research. And so being able to give a conference presentation gives us the freedom to devote some of our time to the pursuit of these ideas.
So what will be taking place at this conference? You know, let's say I wanted to go. How would I be able to go? What do I have to do? And what would I be doing there?
Right. So it is too late to present to propose a presentation mm-hmm. because the abstracts are currently out to review by subcommittees. Mm-hmm. But what will happen at the event is we will have a series of panels in which scholars who do research about the band will present their work. There will be sort of approximately three panels on Friday. We're going to do a half day on Friday. Saturday will be a full day of events. We're going to bring in a band from Oregon, Left on Wilson, who is comprised of a number of Phish fans. They occasionally play some Phish covers, so there'll be some entertainment in the evening after the event. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have another half day on Sunday. It's open to the public, so anybody can register. In March, the program will be available and registration will be open.
So how does somebody enroll in the course as well? This year's course, right, that's coming up?
Yeah, the course is offered every summer. So mm-hmm. you can enroll, you can find enrollment information on the class website.
Okay. And the best place, that's philosophyschoolofphish.com.
Philosophyschoolofphish.com. Yeah. So every year when registration opens for the summer term, I post the information for how to go about signing up for the class. And you can always email me. My email is stephanie.jenkins@oregonstate.edu.
So what else is in the future for you as well as the Philosophy School of Phish? You know, you got this conference coming up. What else can people mm-hmm. expect?
So with the Philosophy School of Phish, I hope to continue to offer the class every summer, as well as planning more educational events at live music concerts for my students, but also Phish fans who want to participate. A project that I am really excited about right now is that I am co-editing a special issue of the Public Philosophy Journal about Phish and philosophy. Ah. So this is going to be the first academic journal to devote an entire issue to Phish. And it also will be, it's not just directed towards Phish fans, right? Mm-hmm. This is an academic philosophy journal. So it's going to be read by my colleagues who aren't Phish fans. And my hope is that it will demonstrate the scholarly relevance of the band, its music, and our community. Mm-hmm. It's also an innovative project in the field of public philosophy. And so far, it's kind of an unprecedented collaboration between Phish.net and the Public Philosophy Journal. My co-editor on this issue is Charlie Dirksen, who is the associate counsel for the Mockingbird Foundation.
Right.
And the editorial team also includes two professional philosophers who are not Phish fans.
Let me ask you something. You mentioned Charlie Dirksen real quick here. Do you feel that they played Party Time?
So
is there a philosophical answer to this? Like, do we? Or it's a yes or no.
So the Party Time debate is a great example of how Phish fans engage with philosophical ideas like music ontology, right? Whether or not they played Party Time is built around what counts as a song, right, and what are the elements of the song Party Time.
Right. Yeah, but I asked if do you feel that they played Party Time?
Where do I fall down? So I do not think they played Party Time.
Interesting. I can't make up my mind. I for the longest time I was like, no, they didn't. Then I said they did, and now I'm, because other people are saying they did, now I'm saying they didn't. So I don't know, whatever. But you know, that's the thing. We can debate and philosophize about this forever whether or not they played Party Time.
Right. It might make a great future case study for the class. Yeah. For the first unit of music ontology, the example that I give them there is I have them listen to this is the very first thing they listen to from Phish, is a vacuum solo from Phishman.
Nice.
Right. Is that music?
Right.
And why? And so their initial gut reaction is,
yes.
No, it's awful. Right. and then they do the reading and they come back and say, well, actually, right.
Right. Right.
And so Party Time is sort of the reverse, right? In the moment, in the experience, or how philosophers would call it, the phenomenology of Party Time. Uh-huh. Like I just assumed they were playing Party Time. That's how I experienced it in the moment when I was at the shows.
Yeah, me too. Right. Right. That's why I was thinking at first. Yeah, of course they did. But then I thought about it more.
But then after I got home and realized that the internet had kind of blown up around this question of did they play Party Time,
right,
I went and listened to sort of the album version and compared it to the live version, and I guess they didn't play Party Time. Right. So I can understand why there's so much controversy around it, and that it's different perspectives on what counts as the performance of a song. There's sort of the fan embodied experience at the show versus sort of the technical musical composition of the song.
Yeah. Well, when can people expect to see the journal that you were talking about there?
So it will be published within the next year. Right now it's slated for approximately the fall term. Because we are currently in the process of selecting the essays that will be included in that issue, the timeline might change a little bit.
All right. Well, Dr. Stephanie Jenkins, assistant professor at the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State University, and has been an excellent guest here on All Things Reconsidered Live. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me here. This has been fascinating. I have learned a lot. Thank you so much. Before I let you go, Stephanie, is there anybody you would like to thank, acknowledge?
Yes. So I really want to say thank you to the program committee for the Phish Studies Conference. It wouldn't be possible without their help. And so the other members of the program committee are Christina Alaback, Janon Blau, Jacob Cohen, Natalie Dollar, Paul Jackis, and Elizabeth Yeager. And I'd also like to thank my current director of the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State University. She's been incredibly supportive of my Phish Studies projects and even approved funding for the field trip during the Gorge Run this summer.
Awesome. Again, thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for talking to me about philosophy.
Hey, absolutely. Welcome anytime. And do keep in touch with anything else you got coming up. All right.
I'll be sure to let you know when the journal goes live.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you so much again for coming on, and take care.
Bye. Take care of your shoes.
Thank you.
Check out the all-new JampRadio.com for show info, merch, listen live links, and more. JampRadio.com.